Good evening, you guys. I'm K2, Romeo, India Whiskey. My name is Dick. You'll hear a group of guys tonight that run the TechNet. That's KC2, WGB, John, WS2N, Paul. Occasionally we hear from Mahal, K6DPZ, and me, K2RIW. This will be TechNet number 1617 of the series that began 34 years ago now, September of 1982, so it's 34 years ago. Lots of TechNets, lots of subjects have been discussed. This is a gathering of people who have the curiosity, where they want to know more about how the equipment works, how to make it work better. In other words, the people who gather here would rarely be called so-called appliance operators. These are the so-called real hams that want to know how the stuff works and how to make improvements to it. The action at a distance of radio is a really piece of magic. And in fact, you can put a couple of watts into an antenna, and a guy thousands of miles away hears your signal and is communicating with you. Quite a bit of magic goes on between that transmitting antenna, that receiving antenna, and the thousands of miles in between. Let me drop. So how that all happens is not super clear. Very loose schedule that we follow is that for the first hour we take people who sign in because they do have a question or a comment. Need not sign in because you just are listening. After 34 years we believe somebody is listening. That doesn't have to be proven anymore. So first hour is those questions and answers, those sign-ins and questions and comments of that. That's followed by John, KC2WGB, who watches the Echo Link. If you have trouble signing in because we're a little too quick on the switch and we don't wait for the four beeps, John knows about that. I think he also monitors IRLP, but his main function in life, as far as the TechNet is concerned, other than those things, is the mailbag. People who don't yet have the right license or don't have the right equipment so they can talk to us directly, by one means or another, they talk to John. They send him a message. And John chooses a few of those, and we discuss those communications as to what people want to know. Let me drop. That's followed by Paul, WS2N, our space expert. And there'll be a lot to talk about tonight because of that explosion on the launch pad in Florida by Mr. Elon Musk. And that's one of many things that Paul has spent a good fraction of his life studying what each of the space agencies are doing, particularly NASA, but also the European and Asian space agency. He keeps track of all of those, and he gives us the latest report on what they're doing, what they intend to do. We got some real good things to look forward to coming up in the next couple of years. The James Webb Space Telescope, for instance, is one of the things to really look forward to, which is going to be launched in 2018. It's a tremendous amount larger than Hubble Space Telescope, and it sees through all the clouds in infrared, so it's going to be doing some direct viewing of things like that newly discovered planet that's going around Proxima Centauri. Let me drop. So the James Webb Space Telescope can possibly do direct viewing and figuring out what the atmosphere is like and what does it consist of. That just gives you some examples of what I think Paul will be discussing. One of the things that was asked last week is Ed, KC2PYT, who's concerned about the fact that the FCC has officially announced a couple of years ago that we amateurs, if we radiate more than 50 watts on a VHF frequency, for instance, we're responsible for doing a calculation as to what is the radio frequency biohazard, how much milliwatts per square centimeter, or how many volts per meter is your antenna putting out, how close can a person stand to it and still be safe. So John was asking those questions. We got a little bit into it. I've come up with some of the numbers, as I promised, as to how that measurement can be made with relatively simple equipment that we own. So we'll be getting into that. Okay, right now I'm going to, in a minute, pass it over to people who want to give us a check-in, because they're going to give us their call letters, their name, and the word yes, which means they do have a question or a comment for the net. K2 two eyes will be listening. Give us your check-ins right now. Hey, there's nobody out there. Everybody's on vacation and they're away. Do we have no check-ins tonight? Nobody has a question or a comment for the TechNet? Give me your call letters and name right now. I guess we're gonna close down early tonight, John. We'll give a little bit of a buzz, and then maybe we'll go over to the mailbag real early. Keep your eyes to be listening for any check-ins, and if not, John's gonna pick up and say something.
Roger, Roger. This is KC2 Queen Yankee Whiskey. Name here is Joe, and yes.
WS2N, I doubled with John, so good evening, Dick. We're here for the ES Space Report.
Okay, got Joe. And Paul, you do or don't have a question when you were checking in. Over to you, Paul.
No question at this time.
Okay, one more call. Anyone to check in to the TechNet because you do have a question or comment? Please give me your call letters and name right now. K2LAW.
I bet I could come up with something. This is KC2SHO John in Mount Laurel.
Yes.
Okay, we got KC2SHO John. Mount Laurel, I think that's in New Jersey. And are you coming through, John, tonight by RF, or is it, or am I listening to you by Echolink? Over to you, John.
Yeah, Dick, I'm coming in to you tonight via IRLP. I have a node here in southern New Jersey, not far from Philadelphia. You guys are live on a local repeater here. I've been doing it just about every Sunday for quite a while now. So you guys have a presence down here in South Jersey as well. K2RIW, KC2SHO.
Very fine, John. What is the call letters or frequency of that repeater in southern New Jersey that we're coming out of that's near your QTH?
Yeah, so my node is on, just to give you all the info, my node is on a frequency of 144.265. I cross-band repeat that over to the WB3EHB repeater, which has an input of 448.100 and an output of 443.100. K2RIW, KC2SHO.
Very fine, John. Lots of information. Thank you. One last call. Anyone else to check in because you do have a question or a comment tonight? Give me your call letters and name right now. K2RIW.
Hello, 2 Mike Uniform Foxtrot on the North Shore, waiting for the high winds and high tide. We're running on emergency power, just waiting for our power to go out with the high wind. K2MUF listening.
Okay, Mr. K2MUF, please tell us your name, sir.
This is Joe, and we're running battery power.
You're doing that as practice, Joe, or is there some reason why your local power is not there?
Negative, we have power. We're just charging our batteries and we're waiting for the high wind to come. If we get 40 mile an hour gusts, we lose our power right away.
What town are you in, Joe, that such a small amount of wind can make you lose power? Over to you, Joe.
A lot of trees around, and the power lines run right through the trees. We're in Ridge, R-I-D-G-E, Ridge, Long Island, on the North Shore.
Yeah, I know where that is very well. My hometown for my later teenage years was Middle Island, which is right alongside of Ridge. Okay. Joe, number one, KC2, QIW. What would you like to discuss tonight, Joe? K2IW. You got it, Joe, number one.
For Roger, Roger. How you guys doing? And my question to you is, when there's like a, let's say, interference or maybe a jamming up any kind of repeater system out there. My question to you is, what kind of equipment does the FCC use to track down a jammer or some kind of other interference? And that's my question to you, Dick. Like, you know, when the FCC is in the mobile, I was just wondering what kind of equipment they use. Back to you.
As you probably know, there was a report of over the last week of a particular amateur on Long Island, a non-amateur, a person on Long Island who was doing quite a bit of mischief on first responder frequencies, police frequencies, fire frequencies, as well as ham radio. And the FCC did pin him down by direction-finding equipment. What exact direction-finding equipment they used, I don't know. But I'm reasonably sure they do have direction-finding equipment. In other words, they can drive around with a vehicle and say, hey, that signal is coming to me to the north. And they proceed to the north and see the signal get stronger and eventually pin it down to an exact building. And they did. They pinned it down to an exact building. And eventually the person was caught with all that equipment. Eventually the equipment was confiscated. Eventually he was fined, and I think he's incarcerated. So I know that they do have direction finding equipment, but you and I would like to know, is it brand so-and-so direction finding equipment? I wonder if anyone within the sound of my voice knows what kind of direction finding equipment, what brand name, model number, and what technique of operation the FCC is using over the last few years. If you got that information, please sign in right now. K2IW listening.
By triangulating with three people, three volunteers, you can do it.
Okay, I don't know who that was. The signal was only there about 40% of the time, very heavily chopping out. Maybe you're on the Southern State Parkway, which is one of the places that has rather poor coverage in this particular repeater. But you did say triangulation is taking place with three people. Yes, if you get three people displaced and they all take a bearing, and now you you look on the map where those three bearings cross, in theory, that's where the person is. I had the impression from the report that I read that they pinned down this particular individual using only two people, not three. But that can be enough if the person transmits long enough. And by the time you get real close, what we amateurs do is that when we think we're real close, we take the rubber duck off the handy-talkie, and you still hear the signal. And then you can actually use your body as shielding. In other words, by putting the radio against your stomach and rotating your body, you can find out which way the signal is coming from, even when you're super close. And with any further information on how the FCC does direction finding, give me a call, let us right now. K2IW in the TechNet.
W2NPG Mobile.
Okay, that sounds like Whiskey 2 November Papa Golf NPG is what it sounded like. Correct me on the call letters, tell me your name, and then proceed with your information, sir. K2RIW, my name is Dick.
Yes, Dick, it's Neil. It's W2 November Delta Golf. Heading home from weekend upstate. I can't tell you how the FCC exactly does it. I just want to mention there's so many different methods. As you get closer to a signal, you can tune off frequency. There are attenuators made that you hook up usually between a handheld and a directional antenna that automatically create an offset frequency. So that's one way of doing it. Antenna off, you mentioned, or an adjustable attenuator, which gives you a similar effect. A method I use when we're transmitter hunting is to use the second and third harmonics of the frequency. I have a radio that'll pick up both of those. And the third harmonic, when you you get a signal on that, you're usually pretty close. For some reason, the second harmonic is usually much weaker on most radios, and you are usually right on top when you get that second harmonic. So there's a few more methods. I'm going to drop for a second because my own timeout's going to kick in. A good way to get more information about direction finding equipment in general is if you go to Ham Radio University in January, there is a class taught by Larry WA2SUH and Andy WA2CDL on transmitter hunting and direction finding, where they talk about all the different methods. And Larry and Andy have a group that transmitter hunts usually once or twice a month. And if you want any more information on that, you can pop me an email at whiskey2novemberdeltagolf@limark.org. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, thank you, Neil. That's good information. Well, a little bit of fox hunting I've done, I like to do it with a step attenuator to attenuate the signal when you get real close, because your rest meter gets pegged and it's kind of hard to know when you're going in the right direction. By listening to the second and third harmonic, I never thought about doing that. And the second or third harmonic being created in the front end of your own radio that's being overloaded, or is it the real second or third harmonic of the actual transmitter? I guess that's sort of academic, almost doesn't count. If you're listening to 146 megacycles, the second harmonic is 292, and the third harmonic is 438. Not many of us have radios that will tune 292 or 438. So I guess something like an ICOM R7000, you know, one of these things that goes 25 megs to 2 gigs inclusive, that can do that. So wondering what kind of a radio you're using that has that wide of frequency coverage. I guess some of the inexpensive radios that we've got these days come pretty close. W2NDG, K2RIW. Go ahead, Neil.
Actually, most of your modern HTs will do the 438. The 292 is another story. But even though your, you know, $25 Baofengs will do the 438 frequency, they're not good for fox hunting. You don't have a really good usable signal strength indicator, and it's really hard to get a general idea of signal strength out of those radios. I use an ICOM ICT90A, which has wideband receive. It's a tri-band handheld, and most of the ASU VX series will also cover all those frequencies. So there's plenty of radios made that'll do it. What's nice about my ICOM is it also has a switchable single step attenuator, but it's enough that I can usually walk right to the bunny wherever it is. As far as where the harmonic's coming from, I think it's a combination of the two things you're saying, but it's mostly from the transmitter, because all transmitters do put out that harmonic. It just has to be below a certain level to be legal. We're familiar with the bunnies that are used, either Andy's or another couple of them that we usually kick in and use when we have the fox hunts.
Now, if the guy doing the transmitting that you're trying to fox hunt on is sending out FM modulated audio, when you're listening to the second harmonic or the third harmonic, you're listening to a hell of a lot wider FM deviation. And therefore, your discriminator might become overloaded, and you might hear a lot of distortion. So I wonder, do you have a radio that you leave on the basic frequency so you can hear clear audio at the same time you're listening to the second and third harmonic? Which, in some cases, I think the third harmonic, you're going to hear over-deviated distortion if the person is talking. That's a guess on my part, Neil. Into W2NDG, K2RIW on the TechNet.
When we're still mobile, my favorite fox hunting rig is an old Kenwood TR9000 that I picked up because it has an RF gain control. So you can understand how valuable that is in fox hunting. But what I do is I keep the ICOM up somewhere, either by the dashboard or in the little hole in the armrest, tuned to that second harmonic with antenna in it, and I know that when I hear that radio kick in, that I'm within, you know, half a mile, three-quarters of a mile of the signal, maybe less. But when I go out on foot, I just carry the one radio. And surprisingly, there's not as much distortion as you would think. Maybe that's a product of the transmitter that's being used in that particular bunny, but that's the way it works. My wife, KD2CHE, and I, when we hunt, by the way, are usually the only fox hunters in that group who do not use a Doppler. So, something that they usually talk about in that same class at HRU every year is the technique for not using a Doppler. And we're usually successful. So, anyway, once again, I'm not sure exactly what the FCC does, but I think they have a pretty high-end, expensive Doppler system.
That would have been my guess, Neil, that they're using a Doppler scanner. Now, the Doppler scanner, when it's working well, gives you an exact bearing, so to speak. Very useful pieces of information. And you have to do a little bit of mental integration, because if you're driving around the marble canyons of New York City, where there's a lot of reflections, the apparent direction of arrival will hop around a little bit. But I presume the main direction is what you will see displayed most of the time. And by mental integration, you can figure that out. I'm guessing the Doppler scanner people, if it's working well, give you some healthy competition, and they can get there a little bit sooner, is my guess. It sounds to me like you're the kind of guy that likes fishing on a four-pound test line, a little bit more of a challenge. You've decided to do it without Doppler scanner. Is that sort of true, Neil? And if the price was right, and if you could get one that worked very well, would you switch over to a Doppler scanner? W2NDG, K2LAW.
You know, I have so much fun not using it. And sometimes we do, you know, come in, you know, towards the front of the pack. We've gotten first once or twice, once recently. It happens. I don't know. I'm the same way with my computer career. Is, you know, I started by doing things that people told me couldn't be done. Doing that. There's some other way, but one, I think a combination of the technique would be pretty good. The Doppler people within our hunting group all have very good systems and usually can find their way right to the transmitter pretty quickly. So, but every now and then you have, as you know, reflections and ghosts and other issues that make it difficult to find. So,
I think the group that does fox hunting, I think they call themselves Lithark or something like that. Andy is certainly one of those. And I believe approximately once a month, probably on a Friday night, you guys go out and do fox hunting. You designate somebody as a bunny, and then everybody tries to find them. Is that approximately what takes place, Neil? W2NDG, K2LAW.
Yes, that's the basic idea. We have a Yahoo group, which is where the messages go out. And like I said, anybody who's interested can contact me via the Limark email, w2ngg@limark.org. And we all go to the diner afterwards and chit-chat and have a good time. It's a good social event. It's good practice. It's good skill. It's a lot of fun. We enjoy it. So, Dick, I'm going to start getting choppy because I only have 10 watts. So I'll probably let the net go and go on to the next question, or back to the original one at this point. W2NDG Mobile, I'll be listening from here on in. Thanks for letting me talk about transmitter hunting.
You're still sounding very good, Neil. I guess you think you're going near the edge of your range to the repeater, but you're sounding good, and I'm hearing you on the input very well, by the way. Very good information. Thank you. So it looks to me like direction finding, fox hunting, is another one of the many hobbies. If there was 26 kinds of ham radio, maybe fox hunting is the 27th. So there are people who do that competitively for the fun, checking out their top scans, checking out their ways of zeroing in on the repeater, even if they don't have a direction finding system, just by measuring amplitude and using the harmonics as an attenuator, or using a real attenuator. That's pretty crafty. So, probably have some more questions about all of this, Joe, and sounds to me like you might enjoy getting involved with Fox Hunting. KC2, QIW, K2IW, and TechNet. You got it, Joe.
QTZ.
QTZ recognized. We're going to go to Joe first, and then Bill next. Go ahead, Joe.
Yeah, Roger, Roger. Yeah, our club does Fox Hunting, too, but they usually do it, like, on Sunday, like 8:30 in the morning, and sometimes, you know, sometimes I can't get up at 8:30 in the morning, so I never got a chance to do it, so maybe this coming up year, I'll try to do it, and I have a funny feeling that I don't have my computer on, but if anybody has a computer near them, and maybe go on YouTube, and maybe type up, how does FCC track down a jammer or interference or something like that, because I'm pretty sure they must use some kind of high-end computer system or a laptop computer with a scope and all different kinds of equipment in their FCC car or SUV, something like that. So yeah, Dick. So in 2 weeks from now, I might ask the same question. When we have a lot more amateur radios on the TechNet, so it's a good thing to know about. And back to you.
Dick, most of our hunts are Friday night. Just thought I'd mention that.
Pretty fine deal. That's what I thought. I remember Andy CDL saying that the Friday night is when the fox hunting takes place. And Bill, let's see. How do the smart guys in Massapequa do fox hunting? I wonder if you've been tempted to get or you already own a Doppel scanner. And I wonder how many fox hunts you've gone on. And maybe you're familiar with what the Friendly Candy Company is using. WB2QTZ, K2LIW, go ahead, Bill.
Hey, good evening, WB2QTZ. Sort of joining in. Gotta mash the button to talk. Sort of joining in progress, I was sort of assuming you might, that's where this was going, because I came in sort of in the middle of the question, in the middle of the Neil earlier. And I have a Doppler thing I use once in a while. Let's see what's making that noise, probably this. I have gone out a couple times on Friday nights as work has permitted, and I usually, I'll ride with Andy, and then I see everybody over the diner and have breakfast for dinner, and it's a load of fun, so it's a cool group of guys to hang out with. I mean, honestly, the bulk of stuff, and I've done some stuff at work where it was sort of a group effort between us and some FCC folks to find some stuff. The bulk of the work is done by driving around until it's strong, and then typically looking on foot. I mean, that most of my interference is using a Rodin Schwarz PR100 with a very well optimized set of log periodics or that magnetic antenna you saw on field day. And I mean, that for a CW carrier, for somebody who's talking on a two-way or something, that's it's a piece of cake. There are some automated devices. Wait. Which I have used. I own one of them at work. So they're basically automated things which take measurements of one sort or another and give you a map with which develops into a heat map and drops a pin where the interference is pretty much. Now, if you give me a CW source, I can probably be there within 8 minutes. With the automated device, the Rode is kind of neat, and it's pretty expensive. It's approximately $120,000 plus the $60,000-ish receiver that goes with it, and that's a pretty big, pretty ostentatious radome encrusted set of band specific antennas, and that works pretty good. Using that device, I was able to just blindly follow the map drive to the dot, and with my hand out the driver's seat, I could touch the car that had the emitter in it, which was kind of cool. Now, in Ritsu, that, and that's based on a lot of thinking. In other words, the device knows at this frequency, at this direction, the phase relationship between all of the antennas in my array is this. And it looks that up, and that's how it does its plotting. It's not really a Doppler sort of affair. The Enritsu and the Viavi devices, which are much less expensive, on the order of maybe $25,000 approximately each, plus the cost of the receiver, are based on channel power measurements. And it takes a little bit longer, but not markedly. If you're bouncing around a lot, it takes a while for any of these systems to integrate the reflections out. All of them do. And even the Enritsu device, the same deal. It took me somewhere between 8 and 10 minutes to having no idea where the emitter was, driving down the highway to pick it up, have the device tell me to make a right, make the heat map more and more red, and then drop a red pin, basically, that I drove to. So,
repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Okay, wait till you lose me.
Don't worry, we only lost one word, Bill. When it comes to the commercial equipment that you've got access to, the $100,000 type, wow. That's the right way to do it. I suspect you haven't used that ham radio-wise very much. Ham radio-wise, yes, you go with Andy in his vehicle sometimes, but will you own a Doppler scanner of your own? Doppler scanners, some people have had need to do quite a bit of tweaking to get rid of some of the glitches that they've got. So I wonder what brand you've got, how satisfied you are with it, how much modification you had to make, how reliable do you believe it is, the Doppler scanner that you own, Bill. To V2QGZ, K2RIW.
W2QGZ. So I have two. I have an original Doppler Systems device, which worked pretty well. I used that in the mid-late 90s, and it worked pretty well. Recently, I got up, I think, at the convention in Hartford or New Haven or whatever it was 2 years ago, 3 years ago. The new smaller device which interfaces with your computer, I know Eric's familiar with them, a handful of guys bought them. I don't remember the name of it. But it's kind of a new general consensus standard of ham DS stuff, I guess. And it works pretty good. It will interface with Google Maps on your computer, so between a GPS and Google Maps, it will generally maintain a bearing for you, and if you drive around long enough, it'll do a bunch of integrated measurements, and you drive a big enough circle, and it's going to start to put bearing lines in the vicinity of where your emitter is. I mean, I've used it to prove it works, basically. I wish I had more time to fool with it. When I'm doing junk at work, it's typically I have a gun to my head to go find it, so, get back to something else. So, the bulk of my stuff at work, again, is I have a little broadband antenna outside. I look at the interference from the receiver that's getting beaten up. I know what it looks like, and then I just kind of, most of the antennas I deal with are directional. So I go in that general vicinity and try to find it, make it nice and strong, and then I just narrow it down with that very well-optimized log periodic. That log periodic I use, I think I told you, it's a 500 megahertz to 7.5 gig log, and it works. It surprised me for such a small antenna, as did the price tag.
Yes, when I met you at the field day site this year, I believe you and I literally took that thing apart to see what was inside, to see how it works. Is that the one you're talking about now, Bill? Beautiful piece of hardware. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, just in case the manufacturer is listening, I cannot confirm or deny that. But yes, we were wondering what was inside there. The one that we looked at was a 100... megahertz to 250 megahertz or something like that, or a 50 to 250 or something like that. It was a lower split antenna. That's the one that we were fooling with. The other one is was a little bit more difficult to visualize what was inside. but it was our assumption it's just a circuit board style log inside some of the guys I work with refer to that particular antenna as the shuttle because it looks like an entrenching tool.
Yeah, although Bill is not allowed to say it, so to speak, I'm going to say it. Bill does work quite heavily with maintaining cell sites, and so when it comes to the interference that interferes with the cell system, and you have to track that down, roughly how often does that happen, Bill? Is that something like once every 2 weeks? You're tracking down an extraneous signal that's giving grief to a particular one of your sectors of a cell site? Over to you, Bill, K2LIW.
Yeah, you know, it's very irregular. On a region-wide thing, I would imagine we're probably hitting two of them a month. But, you know, sometimes it gets busy. I have a thing that popped up Friday that's affecting three locations over in Hempstead. So that's probably what we're going to go look at Tuesday morning. A lot of times these things are caused by unintentional radiators, meaning somebody's piece of equipment that has become defective. So a lot of times I'll try to give stuff 48 hours at least before we start getting crazy about them, because a lot of times people either figure out the device isn't working properly and unplug it, fix it, or it just dies. And, you know, a lot of these things make an incredible amount of power in places, unintentional places like the cellular uplink bands. And lots of power, surprising amounts of power there based on the received signal level I'm seeing. And that generally indicates a lot of heat and generally indicates that it's gonna burn up or get attention. And, probably, for me, at least 40% of them don't make 2 days. But then the things we're looking for, a lot of times, I know the FCC dudes that we've bumped into in the field. They do loads of pirate FMs, and that's kind of fish in a barrel. Any sort of narrow band emitter is pretty easy. A lot of the stuff we're looking for is maybe 15 megahertz wide, and it's an undulating signal with all kinds of amplitude variations. So it's a little bit harder to quantify when it's a good signal or when it's not, or in other words, what azimuth is good and what azimuth isn't. Which is why some of these things, like the Rode PR-100, allow you to capture, 25 megahertz at a clip with less than a 500 millisecond sweep time, and give me a...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Good timing, Bill. We only lost one word. When it comes to the actual things you discover that are doing this unintentional emission that's jamming your input frequencies, I believe you described to me one time it was a television preamplifier mounted at the antenna that had broken into oscillation. It was mounted in an attic. So give us a couple of hints, a couple of examples of the actual things that start doing this. I presume preamplifiers that are left on that in some cases are not being used. I'm having trouble believing that an ordinary television receiver would do it. But of the unintentional emitters that are jamming your systems that you've discovered over the last few years, give us a couple examples of the weird ones or the typical ones, Bill. WP2QGZ, K2LIW.
Okay, well, as a lot of people have started occupying former TV spectrum at 700, a lot of things like fluorescent ballasts and LED bulbs are killers, and they're all over the place, and they're a headache. As far as interference in the 17 and 1800 megahertz area where the uplink is for the PCS and the AWS spectrum, a lot of those TV mass matter TV preamps, there's one particular round saucer looking radar radome encrusted TV antenna, which is a little LP or something, set in a styrofoam disc with a preamp built into it, and they tend to break into oscillation. There's also a handful of amplified antennas that are sold, or antennas with a preamp that are sold as part of a package with these devices that plug into your computer to watch your off-air TV or over-the-air TV on your computer. And I'm not going to time out this time, so wait. So we see quite a few of those. That's probably one of my biggest, the most frequent things we hit. Weird things. So recently I had a couple of, every single one of them in this one particular building, about 7 40-year-old gas-fed infrared radiant heaters that all emitted noise at about 695 to 710 megahertz, very broadband noise. That's probably gonna reappear once it starts getting cold, and we're gonna have to go back there. And believe it or not, probably 4 or 5 years ago, a motor in a car wash that pulled the set the wheels in the track and pulled the car through. That motor was making noise at 1700 megahertz, almost half a mile, a little bit more than half a mile away from the site.
Unusual. Now, the gas-fed heater, what in the world? I guess there's an electronic regulator in there of some kind that's turning on and off as a function of temperature, and somehow that circuit became unstable and radiates at UHF frequencies. Bill, go ahead.
Not 100% sure. It seems like, I tried getting some information from the manufacturer. The current person who makes that same make and model and name says they're not the guys who made the old ones, and they don't want to talk. Not a lot of information online except for a couple of eBay listings for that style of heater, but no real information. I did find some patent documents for, this stuff sort of spreads a flame. It's ignited by a little arc device that pulses like your barbecue igniter. And that eventually turns off. So there is a circuit that says, yep, there's heat coming off of here and potentially flames, so we're not dumping gas into the room. But there's some way that over that medium that's built into the heater, now these heaters look like these things, if you go to Home Depot in the winter and you look up over the cash registers, that's what these things are like. So they have some kind of medium of this, like, white stuff that the flame is dispersed equally across, and it's it typically glows orangish and makes that radiant heat, which is directed downward. There's some kind of oscillator that operates in that device that causes that flame to disperse across that medium properly. And that's about as far as I got. It's not supposed to be on the frequency it's on, but back in the day, nobody was really looking at TV channel 52 to see if the lamps caused interference. Now I'm receiving there with big antennas all over the place, and it's a bigger deal. It's more obvious. So these things have probably been bad for 30 years, or maybe came out of the box doing this.
Now, if an organization like Home Depot is using those kind of heaters, and they're emitting these signals, to try to talk them into stopping to use that, and to use some of the brand, or to switch over to another model number. My guess is that's not easy. Is that true, Bill? Over to you, K2LIW.
Well, I did look at some of the more modern devices. The ones I was looking at were probably at minimum 40 years old, the ones that caused me the interference. I looked at a couple of brand new ones made by that same manufacturer, and I did not find where they were emitting, but it wasn't within 100 megahertz of where I was. So I lost interest at that point. So these are different than what are sold, that are sold these days. The company that the current company says the other ones haven't been made in 30 years. So, I'm assuming if, I guess that's the truth. So these would only be places where they still have them in operation. And perhaps they all have to fail in the same way. I'm not sure, but in this particular instance, now, and I feel bad for the guy. He's running on a pretty tight budget, and I'm telling him he's got to change all these things out. And eventually, he kind of said, "Well, no, I'm just not going to do it." And that's, at that point, the FCC kind of had to become involved, and that's where this thing sits now, I guess. So you know, it's no longer my fight, and we'll, you know, we'll see how it plays out.
So if I understand correctly, the FCC has confirmed that these things are emitting on vital frequencies for cell site service. Therefore, the FCC is telling this particular Home Depot division, you're going to have to change those things, no matter what it costs. You can't keep doing that. And so the FCC, I guess they got two or three steps in which they get tougher and tougher. And pretty soon, if you don't respond, you start getting fined. Is that approximately what happens, Bill? WB2QGZ, KQIW.
This is not a Home Depot. I did look at some of the ones in a Home Depot, which are much more modern versions of the ones giving me trouble. The ones that give me a problem are located in a factory-style building that's, you know, it's all old legacy equipment. So the Home Depot ones do not seem to emit the modern ones. I'll say anything built in the last 20 years don't seem to cause this problem. And yeah, I'm not 100% sure what they do. Now, in my case, this, you know, I had a meet with them because they wanted to see firsthand what I saw and let them see it on their test equipment. And I guess the day they went out, the guy didn't have the heaters on and declined to turn them on. So we went back when it was cold and, you know, was able to display to their satisfaction that it was indeed coming out of those lights. So they looked at it with their stuff, I looked at it with my stuff, and we agreed that's where it was coming from.
And the degree of interference you experienced is a function of how strong was the source, how many miles away, and the grief that it created. If we try to put a very rough number on it, was it knocking down the sensitivity of your system by, say, 10 dB, Bill? Over to you, K2IW.
Probably a little bit more than that. So I would like to have, you know, what I'll call a clean noise floor of around a minus 110, which is, it's a complicated way of doing it. It's a noise power bandwidth measurement, but it's taken over five much, much smaller chunks or subbands of 5 megahertz, and then all of the individual noise power measurements are averaged together to give me one, what we call RSSI. It's not really an RTWP or received total wideband power. It's not a noise power measurement. But I would like to see about a minus 108, minus 110 in that band. And probably what I was seeing was somewhere between a minus 82 and minus 88, give or take, something like that. And it was kind of interesting to find this because now there's 7 heaters in the ceiling and over a, you know, 100 by 100 building, which makes for a very diffused kind of source. That was a little challenging to narrow down, and it was only sort of by mistake I found it because, you know, I did find it had a regular on-off cycle, which generally corresponded with the building coming up and down. And even though we powered down the mains when that person was cooperative, the noise didn't go away, which really threw me. And I couldn't narrow it down in a building. I mean, you know, every place I walk around, I'm like, it's here, no, it's there, no, it's here. You know, it was very strange. And then eventually, I found out that the heaters were fed from an entirely different circuit we never shut down.
Wow. And of that kind of heater, did everyone do it or just every third one, so to speak? Bill, go ahead.
Every one of that same model number and manufacturer did in that plant, some lesser than others, all a little bit. I mean, some much worse. The other issue is it's not a frequency, a temperature stable emission. So, you know, I was experiencing it, you know, at times intermittent interference, even when it was cold out. And that's because they would drift up above and below me in band. So some days it would appear it went away, but it was really just moving out of my bandwidth.
I've seen things do that. When you get a random oscillation, it doesn't want to sit still. Fantastic. So, where you said minus 82 to minus 88 dBm per 5 megacycles is what I think you're saying, and you'd like to see 110, we're talking about 20 some odd decibels here of desensitization of your system. That's a lot. That's a pretty big hit. And so, therefore, a number of your customers in that particular direction not going to have anywhere near the proper range, and therefore, that cuts down the usefulness of your system. My guess is to solve that particular problem, Bill, I'll bet you it took a couple of weeks. Is that true?
Not as long as you'd think. Listen, I have an incredible amount of interesting statistical information on drops, or how the call dropped. Not call specific information. In other words, I have four handover drops. I have six of these other type of drops. I can see all of those resources and traffic patterns in addition to the noise floor, so we can get a pretty good idea of how it's impacted. And we can see that, we see the impact of traffic as well. One of the other things that happens is now the phones are forced to make higher power to complete their call and stay on the call. So now the subscribers are also impacted in that area, because now their phones are dying in 6 hours instead of 12 hours, so... It's, there's a measurable impact there as well. And I would say beginning to end, as far as figuring out what it was, probably took me, I probably started on a Thursday, and we probably had a handle on it by the following Tuesday or Wednesday.
That kind of troubleshooting is a relatively rare skill, isn't it, Bill? The number of people who claim to be electrical engineering RF savvy that you could hire off the street, that would understand the system, understand how to do all that kind of work. You must be in pretty high demand, is my guess, Bill. WB2QGZ, K2IW.
Well, there's only a handful of guys that seem to have a lot of luck with this, so... there's a commercial entity over in Jersey that does a lot of this. The FCC guys that I bumped into in the field are all really pretty good at what they do. I mean, I'm pretty impressed with their ability. And they're pretty much, doing a lot of this the same way I am. They'll end up making a quantitative measurement when they're done, especially with these FMs. In other words, you look at a lot of the notice of violations, notice of parent liabilities, all these other things they send around, notice of unlicensed operation. They'll say, you were making 22,785 microvolts per meter, which is in excess of what Park 15 is based on the distance and all of that. So they go one further level with the quantitative measurement. I mean, I'm happy to say I turn this switch off, the noise goes away. Let's see what's connected to it and see how I'm going to talk you out of this. And I mean, I've been doing it for a long time, and honestly, I felt that one thing with the heaters was a little bit of a failure, because that was one of the very, very few times, and the first time in recent memory, we actually had to escalate it, where I wasn't able to work with the person who owned the device to remedy it.
Very good. Hang in there, Bill. I think you're doing good work. So, Joe asked a very interesting question. We're going to go over to John now. KC2SHO. What question have you created in the meantime, John? KC2SHO, K2RIW and the Tech Man.
K2RIW, KC2SHO. Let's see. On many occasions you talk about the education aspect of RF professionals and what goes on in that realm. I guess what I've been thinking, I had another question in mind, but as the night went on, I thought more and more about it, and my question for you, and maybe we can elaborate on it, is someone who does not have specific training in the field, like myself who has, but gobs of practical experience, no college degree, what would be a next step, a stepping stone or a good path to furthering my career? Right now it seems to be either I don't have a degree, so I cannot secure any good opportunities, or the opportunities that are out there cannot pay a reasonable salary to keep me interested in pursuing them. So, you know, is it worth pursuing the general radio telephone operator license? Is there a solution there? Is there a private education, you know, and with a family and a full-time job and all these things, going back to college and looking for a double E does not sound like something that's feasible for someone like me. I can elaborate more if need be. K2RIW, what are your thoughts? KC2SHO.
I think I understand what you're asking, Joe. John, sorry about that. When it comes to real RF knowledge, I'm rather disappointed. You've heard me say it so often. The schools almost do not teach it. You can go to a good, respected electrical engineering school, and you tell them I want to specialize in wireless radio frequency. I don't really understand that. They give you what they call basic information, and they think that that's a foundation that's going to be used everywhere. I know that there are a certain number of college professors who tell their students to listen to the technical net, because that's one way you can become exposed to what the real world of radio engineering is like. The schools are stuck in the tradition, they're stuck in the paradigm as to the way they teach the subject, and it takes a fair amount of apprenticeship after education, after you graduate, in order to become skilled at it. A ham radio operator, let me drop it. A ham radio operator that does things like you're doing, John, when I go to QRZ.com and I see the equipment you've set up, the beauty of that setup, the fact that you're establishing that equipment, using it, talking to people who are using it, you're gaining a lot of knowledge in a hurry, faster than you can from the school. The good news is you're getting it. The bad news is proving it to a potential employer. It's not so easy. In the last place that I worked doing consulting work for 10 solid years, there was an extremely skilled RF engineer at that location who has no degree at all. And he's doing the majority of their radio design work. I mean, he's designing complete phase lock loop, receiver, transmitter, radio systems. And doing them at, you know, once every couple of months, and getting, I think he's got about 40 patents. So you can see that there's a disconnect between what the school teaches and what's really needed. And there are people who have become very skilled at it, independent of the school. I consider myself an RF maven. Let me drop it. And I do wireless radio consulting. I've been doing it now for 16 years as an independent person. Before that, I was working as a senior staff engineer at Airborne Instruments Laboratory. 90-some-odd% of the information I use in that occupation at AIL and my own private business, 90% of that information appears to me to have not come from my bachelor or master training. I got it in the field. Unfortunately, what I'm telling you, although it might be true, it doesn't give you a definite direction. By way of what you're doing with ham radio, you're learning the information very fast. You could learn it a bit faster if you wanted to become a little bit more, even more progressive in ham radio. By that I mean build the equipment to get yourself on 10 gigahertz. Talk to the 10 gigahertz people. Let me drop. From my point of view, that's the equivalent of a good master's degree course to establish good equipment with good noise figure and good power output at 10 gigs. Because there's very little commercially made equipment there. You've got to do quite a bit of constructing. and the process of talking to the people that are there and finding out what works and what doesn't work. You learn an awful lot about real microwave radio propagation.